Welcome to Table Talk on Disability Matters, where we continue the intentional conversations we started in person during 2015 on what matters to people with disabilities, their families, and support networks. We place the lens on the best of what is and explore the possibilities of what could be, while stimulating a different view on ability, diversity, and inclusion.
Hello, my name is Rose Flagg, and I have the privilege of being your host on this podcast. I also have the privilege and honor of being on the Board of Directors as past president and chair of Innovative Life Options, an organization that facilitates support for my daughter, who uses a self-administered funding model. Where I live, I am known as Millie's Mom, an identification dear to my heart. The information on this podcast is dear to my heart also. The guiding principles in the legislation we mention appeared in our lives in a timely manner. This discussion is about the legislation and its evolution that directly affects people who are labeled with having an intellectual disability. Before we continue with the podcast, I thought I would provide a bit of history by sharing a story. It is the story of one family that decided to put on what I'll call advocacy boots because they were passionate about their son and community life. In doing so, they didn't just change one person's life, they changed everyone's, everyone that followed. You see, prior to 1996, there was a piece of legislation called the Mental Health Act, which had two parts. Part one of the act included people with mental health diagnosis. Part two covered people with intellectual disabilities. Under this act, it was common practice for two doctors to sign on a committal order to admit people in either classification, often sight unseen, to an institution. Family members could apply for accommodee privileges in order to make decisions on behalf of someone. The public trustee office was the alternative, as it is still today. If an individual fell under Part 2 of this Act, they really had no decision-making rights over their lives. The Department of Families and Services had a fair amount of control over people's lives, regardless of family involvement. In 1989, the Nobess family learned firsthand the extent of this control. Derek Nobess was a vulnerable person who lived in the community in a group home at that time. One Friday, late afternoon, while on a weekend visit at his parents' home, an official from the department knocked on their door. The family was informed that due to Derek's difficult behaviors, he was being moved to the Manitoba Developmental Center. Jean and Ron Nobess believed in community living rights. They took immediate action. They contacted the Association for Community Living Manitoba, and through them, the Public Interest Law Center got involved. And over the weekend, an injunction was brought forward against the government of Manitoba. This suit went on for years. What brought it to a head, finally, was the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, specifically Section 15, which states that every individual in Canada, regardless of race, religion, national or ethnic origin, color, sex, age, or physical or mental disability, is to be treated with the same respect, dignity, and consideration. In 1990, the provincial government, likely recognizing the futility of pursuing this case and trying to charter-proof the Mental Health Act Part 2, reached out for a deal. The Nobess family dropped the suit in exchange for community consultation and new legislation. By 1992, new legislation was passed, but not proclaimed officially until October 1996. Proclamation of the Vulnerable Persons Living with a Mental Disability Act occurred almost 7 years after that fateful Friday. And that is proof that Margaret Mead was right when she said, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has." Well, since then, this legislation has undergone two reviews. The first review was in 2007, and it produced two major outcomes. One being the Adult Abuse Registry to protect people. The other was the implementation of training for all staff who work with people who have an intellectual disability. That training was the result of a collaboration between community and government and is still ongoing. The most recent review occurred in 2020 and produced the Pathways to Dignity report, and this podcast highlights some of the most important areas. We hope you enjoy it, and oh, please listen to the end for my wrap-up, where I provide contact information on the areas that we talk about.
So welcome to another podcast on Table Talk. And this time we're going to be talking with Dale Kendall, who you've been around for a while in the disability field, you would be familiar with, but times change and we know there are new people. So Dale Kendall is going to be talking about Pathway to Dignity, a new document that reviewed the Vulnerable Persons Living with a Mental Disability Act, usually referred to as the VPA. Or the Vulnerable Persons Act, because the other is way too much of a mouthful. So welcome, Dale. I'm really glad to have a conversation about this.
Yeah, good to be here.
So fill in for people who don't know you a little bit of your background and how you got to be such a really very much involved community advocate in regards to people with an intellectual disability.
Well, it's kind of a natural process that I think of. I got involved when I was quite young with a young man at my community club, and we became friends, and we did things together at the community club. And my revelation of this was that I got invited. I was very involved in sports in my early life, actually still are involved, and I was asked to become a staff member for a summer camp. These were all athletic people that were going to be doing some interesting things for the summer. There was a busload of people that showed up at the camp, and there was my friend. He came off as a camper, and I was there as a counselor. And it was like, whoa, I didn't know that. And that was my first revelation of something's different, something it felt right to be in this spot. So I worked with some very young children during the summer, or during the day, rather. But at night, my friend and I, we got together and we would sit down and talk for a couple of hours of just about stuff and how his day had gone. And that was really the start. And then it progressed through a number of things with the Association for Community Living that was known by different names throughout its history. But and I was part of an experimental project in Brandon area that was looking at comprehensive community services. And then I got involved with writing a paper jointly with some people on the future for the association. It was presented in 1975. In 1976, I was invited to become the executive director for community living in Manitoba, which was, to me, going to be for about 5 years, and we'll see how that evolves. And the work became absolutely incredibly interesting because of the diversity of people and the issues and whatnot. And so every 5 years, I said, well, probably another 5 years. So when I retired in 2009, after 34 years as the executive director, I said, that's probably enough. It's time for somebody else to take over. And Rose Flagg took over. And and I stepped back completely, well, sort of completely. Kept my finger in a number of pots, but just on my own schedule. And then just consulting wherever I thought I could be of any assistance. It brought me up to, in 2019, I was involved in a process that was looking at, from the community standpoint, what's wrong with the current Vulnerable Persons Act. And then we were able to convince government that a task force might be a way of getting some recommendations and direction. And I was then asked by the minister, who was Heather Stephenson at the time, Minister of Families, whether I would chair the task force. And we named nine people to the task force. And we completed the work. She went on to become premier. And Rochelle Squires became the minister. And and we continued with those relationships and developing 81 recommendations finally in the report that came out in 2021, September of 2021. It's publicly released. It's a readable document in many forms. It's not one that I would say people are going to pick up and read from cover to cover in the first, but there's a four-page summary in the plain language version in the report that makes excellent quick reading to get the grasp of what were these people thinking about and where the piece of legislation may end up. So,
you know, you're a really great example of inclusion advocate, a lifetime. You know, once you're smitten with a friendship or something that shifts you, that you can't just leave it. And obviously you couldn't either. Yep. What was behind the name? Because it's a much really enabling, empowering, self-directed kind of name.
Whenever in all of the work that I've done with government and with agencies and community families, it's always been difficult to figure out what's a good way to frame something that might be a combination of catchy and realistic at the same time. Certainly in the task force, we struggled over several meetings to figure out what the name of the report could be. We were pretty close on the word pathways. And then pathways to what? Well, we said, okay, we agreed on dignity. And then there were four major components: rights, safeguards, planning, and decision-making. And that those were the four major overriding themes of the entire report. And if you take those individually, each has a very significant section of the document and the recommendations. And then we found a terrific painting by Ryan Smolak that illustrated the pathway and people moving along on a pathway. And it just sort of, those ideas came together. That's a very simplified view of the struggle to get to a name that might be something, but it's now referred to as the Pathways to Dignity document. And I always remind people that it's got the components of rights and safeguards, planning and decision-making, and very impactful kinds of things.
Right. This is an old piece of, well, not that old. It's old if you've been around for a while, but the legislation itself is about 27 years old.
27 years old now.
Now, yeah. Okay. And one of the main components, at least for me, and I think for anybody who's ever supported someone who is labeled to qualify for this particular legislation, and you can go beyond that, but that's a discussion for another time. So if you have an IQ that is in the 70 range, then you would qualify for this particular act. And the five guiding principles, yes, have always been, for me, the best way to support, but also just to live a good life, right? And for everybody. And because I also came into this at the beginning stages, I was able to raise my daughter based on these five guiding principles. And anytime I came up against a little bit of pushback or somebody, you know, in a financial institution or somebody saying, no, that doesn't fit, or no, that's not right, and I would just be, yes, it is. And then, you know, I started adding other bits of legislation and UN conventions to it too, like, no, this is the way it is here. So the very first part of that guiding principle, I think, is the one that not everybody understands or accepts or even grapples. It's not part of our thinking DNA, I think, still. It is for some of us, but not for all of us. This is legislation that says a vulnerable person is presumed to be able to make their own decisions unless they mess up royally. I add that part. You know, I'm paraphrasing, of course. But they have to put themselves into some sort of danger or some make a decision that goes down south in a really bad way before all of those of us who don't have that label really have the right to step in and say, you need some assistance.
We always referred to that in the early days of the legislation as the dignity of risk.
Yes.
That you have to learn how to make decisions. And sometimes you'll make good decisions and sometimes they'll be bad decisions. And sometimes maybe not everybody agrees, but that's your decision, right? And then you have to live with that. But you also have to understand the consequence and the responsibility that goes with the decision. And it's a messy process sometimes. And because of the way things were structured prior to the legislation coming into being in 1996, this was a major, major change of way of thinking about decision making.
This is very true. And it takes decision-making the way we would make it, because we take risks and we might make a decision that isn't as informed as it ought to be and decide, yes, we're going to do that, and then go, oops, maybe not. I think when it's an oops moment, that's where the guiding principle of number three, which would come in.
Yep.
So guiding principle number two says someone who has an intellectual disability, they're encouraged to make choices. And I always used to say, choice making is a muscle. If you don't do a sit-up for a long time and you start making one, you're gonna build some abs, those muscles are gonna be sore for a while.
Yeah.
It is not always easy just to say, well, decide. You know, like, you have to decide. But if you've never made decisions, if it's not part of your everyday thing, that requires practice. I know that I've heard families say, well, you know, helping my son or daughter choose what type of pizza they want or what they want for dinner isn't the same as choosing where they want to live. And I say, but if you do a lot of the choices of what you want for dinner or what do you want to wear, that muscle gets stronger. And if you keep saying, you can choose, you have the right to choose, it's important because it's you, then they'll demonstrate, whether they have spoken word or not, if they want something or don't want something.
Yes. And sometimes that may be the hardest thing for parents to get their heads around when they've for 18 years, they've been making a lot of decisions for their loved one. And then at age 18, these principles come into play and say, well, just a sec, I can make a different choice than what my parents are thinking, you know, and I want to live in a different place. I want to have different kinds of food, and I want to travel, and I want to do things. And you're going, ooh, where is this coming from? And so there's a built-in conflict, but maybe there's a potential conflict between the parents who feel that they're losing control of their son or daughter versus the principal, which is they're encouraging their son and daughter to become as independent as possible.
And if you know about encouraging them at the get-go when they're young, they'll evolve and grow into adults that are quite comfortable in making decisions. Maybe not all the time, but the truth is, as parents, we're quite autocratic. This is what we do. It doesn't matter if you have a child with a disability. You make decisions for them on a regular basis. So practicing someone else to use the muscle for decision-making is a change in thinking, you know, because we see people with a disability as vulnerable, more so than sometimes we ought to. So the third guiding principle is, if someone needs help to make a decision, the legislation encourages family, friends, service providers to help them understand the choices and make an informed decision. That gets tricky too, just a bit like, you know, you turn 18 and all of a sudden you've got different rights. And that's a shock for the family, you're right, because they're not aware, they haven't practiced it, and all of a sudden there's a whole new shift of thinking that they need to deal with. Making an informed decision isn't always easy when someone has non-ordinary communication skills. So what have you experienced has been around that, or what have you heard in that area when you were looking at Pathways to Dignity?
Well, when we consulted with families, they just said that decision-making is complicated. They told us that we've been used to making decisions for our son or daughter. It's hard. We started with simple things. And we're getting better at it. But then we asked people, when you are trying to make decisions, who do you consult with? Who do you talk to about the pros and cons of an idea, or the upside or the downside? And they often said, oh, I talk to my sister. I talk to a family friend that's close. Sometimes I just chat with a neighbor and I gather information. And we say, well, isn't that the same kind of experience that your son or daughter needs to make certain decisions? Yes, it becomes the yes answer in terms of an end. So how do you do that? And so that's where we think the principles of the Act, which were formulated in the early 90s, are still alive and well today, but not necessarily practiced as fully as that we had envisioned back in 96 when it was proclaimed. But the work that preceded, we thought there was a lot of preparation work. And there's still a lot of preparation work to help families that are coming into new situations, and individuals gaining their own independence and strength to say, you know, I don't like that.
Yeah, and it and I get that it's hard for someone who has relied on their family, their parents, and their siblings to help them, to support and guide them and be firm. And all of a sudden they come to the realization that I do have the right to say no. And that's difficult for that person because, you know, you don't want to rock the boat all the time, and that there is a tendency to be people-pleasing when you have that label with you, or you maybe you're from a family who does people-pleasing, who knows. But I think there is that the challenge for the individual themselves trying to find that pathway to how can I do this well and without feeling like I'm going to fail at it. And I think that's the other conversation we don't often have, is when things don't go right.
Yeah.
We promote decision-making, but they don't go right. Are we there to support? Or do we leap into guiding principle number 5, which is, if there is a decision that needs to be made but cannot be made by your family member, even with help, a last resort is a substitute decision can be identified.
Right.
And I think, I would, although I don't have any real evidence, although you might have, Dale, that I'm hopeful that through these 27 years that we've moved from substitute decision-making to supported decision-making, which also brings me to the whole language thing. Those two used to get confused a lot. And I understand now that we're going to start using new words, assisted decision-making.
Yeah, that was a very conscious decision by the task force members that alternate ways of making decisions should be assisted. And that it was, and we were, people reduced things to acronyms. So substitute decision maker becomes an SDM. Well, so does a supported decision maker. And so people think, oh, I'm getting an SDM for my daughter today, and or I'm filing an application for it. And it's, oh, that's a substitute decision maker. No. I just want to help my daughter make certain decisions, like with the local bank and manage her money a lot better, and that kind of thing. Well, so there was confusion. So assisted decision making, I think, is going to be a lot clearer for families. I mean, there'll be some initial confusion about all these letters and things like that. One of the things that people will note in the report, not one acronym was used in the entire writing of the report, and it's 85 pages long. So that was a conscious decision by the group of 9 that if we have to say it, then we'll have a better understanding of it. So when you say substitute decision maker, okay, that has a connotation, an understanding of what's meant. When you say assisted decision making, oh, I'm going to assist somebody to make a decision about their life, but we don't have to take away their rights to do that.
One of the things around the substitute decision-making that I think gets missed and isn't promoted a lot more is around the assisted part of substitute decision-making. The idea is to still engage with that person that you're making those decisions about and on their behalf so that you do get an understanding of what would they really like. And sometimes, you know, there is the emergency when, just before we started the podcast, we were talking about there are times when you do need a substitute decision maker because you're dealing with a system, and within that system are people who don't either understand or aren't at a stage where they can accept or just isn't possible to have a decision making done, right?
The two areas that surface and have been for years with the Act are in the financial end, banking systems, where there's financial transactions that are taking place. And the bank always wants to be careful that somebody's not taking advantage of somebody with the person's money. But do you have to take away the person's rights to get to that? I've always said, no, you don't. You need to have some kind of understanding and framework. And the examples that I always point to is that families that live in rural Manitoba, in smaller communities, who know their bankers, who know the tellers, know the folks around, have a much easier time of getting financial decisions and less challenge being made for the person and asking for a form or a designation of a substitute decision maker to make a decision. The other area is in the area of medical, and it's very, that's complicated. There's a whole series of issues of liability that come up, and that's why I think the medical profession wants to know who can make this particular decision. And it becomes messy, and it gets awkward when there's a life or death kind of decision or a need for an operation that you just have to do it. Who's got the authority to sign off and do it? And oftentimes, it can be a default decision to the public trustee of Manitoba, who can make a short-term decision to get the operation, to get the procedure done. But that also can be achieved by family members stepping forward, or even a very close family friend stepping forward and getting authorization to become that temporary emergency substitute decision maker. So it's not a, you don't have to take away the person's rights for the rest of their life as you used to when you need an emergency and there is an actual decision. It's a last resort decision.
Yeah, it's always a last resort. And actually, prior to this legislation, people had no rights. So there was nothing to be taken away from, really.
Yeah.
No, I mean, you can breathe. That's about it. Yeah. But we'll decide everything else. Yeah. When we were talking about, hitting that lovely age of 18, one of the things that, in preparation for this podcast, you identified the transition protocol as one of the areas that was developed 15, 20 years ago.
At least,
I know I was involved and at least been out of school for a while now. And that at that time, I recall we were adamant that it was, I know I was adamant that schools had to start looking at some sort of transition planning at the age of between 14 and 16. Because otherwise what was happening is they'd reach that 18 and they'd have to stay in school. They had the option of staying in school a little longer, and that was the route that most people would take because, unless they went into some sort of services program. I think it, because it hasn't been used or hasn't been formally practiced, there's some gaps for people happening in that they're not experiencing good transitioning. They're not getting that kind of work experience that they might have gotten that was part of the planning or the options and all of those areas. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, the transition protocol was a joint effort between the community, Department of Families, and the Department of Education. And it was to try and solve a joint jurisdiction problem in terms of how do we help people plan better for the future. We had the framework of the legislation that kicks in at age 18. In the school system, we were asking that at age 14 that there would be the beginning of a process for the individual with a disability and for the family who supports their son or daughter with a disability in terms of being informed. Some school divisions took it to heart and did an excellent job. Others still have the plastic wrapper of the report that sits in somebody's office and they go, yeah, no, I've heard of it, but we haven't done anything very much with it. It's been around. It takes effort, and it's complicated in that there's several different parts of systems involved. There would take the initiative of a teacher or a principal in a school to ensure that each individual with a disability starts the process and that they have some active methods that they're going to communicate on a regular basis with families. They're going to talk about options. They're going to organize evenings where they're going to bring in speakers and people that can assist. Sometimes that happens, sometimes it doesn't. And perhaps people that are listening to this will have their own experience about how that has unfolded. It's also that children under the age of 18, young adults at this point, have a community service worker, but in the children's system. And the unique part is that age 18, they switch to the community service worker adult, and it's a different person. So there's a handoff that happens. And it's even worse in the child welfare system because the handoff is a child welfare worker, and there may or may not be continuity. So it requires people to talk to each other, requires people to pay attention to what I think was a very solid outline of these are the expectations of things that are supposed to happen during age 14, age 16, age 17, age 18. And you talked about the experiences that people were going to be exposed to. Again, it goes to effort, goes to resources, goes to family awareness to ask the questions. I remember the Association for Community Living developed a brochure, and it was called 10 Questions That Families Should Ask About the Transition Protocol. you know, and I know that it was developed prior to, or just prior to my retirement, so I have no idea whatever happened to that, but it was out there. I did see, and I have heard during the task force, that people still refer to it, but that was sporadic. I think that one of the things we discovered in the task force was that there was a revision about to occur that had started before the task force, a revision to the transition protocol, which we said, okay, that's great, but what are you putting in there? Because we're adding in from the task force, we're talking about assisted decision making. That wasn't an option that was being talked about in the previous protocol. We're talking about peer support networks. We weren't talking about that in that protocol. We're talking about where do you get information? How do you coordinate with systems? How do you understand the job descriptions of the key people? You know, revisiting with the Department of Education officials in terms of, are they going to make this any more of a priority area than it, because it needs to be? You know, those kind of things were taking place. So the revision is still in progress. There was a pause in terms of we can't revise a document and put something else out and know that, you know, within a year or so there's going to be a need for another further revision. It's just going to create more and more confusion. So it's on pause. And then we learned that the University of Manitoba was conducting a research study on transitioning from school to adult life. And we made key government officials aware of that particular study. I believe it's about to be completed at the study end, and I hope that it'll have input in terms of what might shape the next stage of the protocol.
Oh, good. That's good to hear.
Yeah, it's exciting. It's an important protocol, and it's a really important, I think the message to families is ask questions.
Yes, and stay involved, because that's how you find the questions and you hear other families talking, and it is an absolute key component of raising a child with a disability. You mentioned two words, peer supports. Mm. You want to talk about that a little bit more?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting concept that has probably been around for a lifetime for most people, but maybe more formalized. Peer support is who do you rely on for information and support when you're going through difficult circumstances? Who do you take advice from and just work with you? Our report in Pathways to Dignity under the planning side of this improvements for families was that we called on government to implement a peer support fund and support a peer support network development. That a group of people that could travel throughout the province, meet with families, help them develop information flow networks of people that in their community that I didn't know that Mrs. Jones down the street was interested in this. I've never talked to her before about this. Or where can I get information? So there's a very active group that is being coordinated through the Family Advocacy Network that are energetic as all get out. And I was told the other day that they have now 650 members of families that are connected in some way, shape, or form through either email contact, social networking, or live in-person meetings. And it's expanding. And I think that's tremendously encouraging for the flow of information and for the questions that will get asked.
FAN, Family Advocacy Network, is, you're right, rolling out all of those meetings. I did attend one in Selkirk, and I had planned to attend one in Gimli in December to see what families are facing and what their stories are, and to bring me back to a better understanding what the issues are, because I think what happens when you have an adult child and they have a good life and everything's going smoothly, but you're still at the heart of it, an inclusion advocate, you need to stay in touch. And it doesn't matter at what stage you're at, because there is, I've jokingly said, as long as there are still paradigms that need shifting, I'm going to be around.
So I believe that.
So let's talk a little bit about, I know you know a little bit about, you know a lot about support networks, the five guiding principles. The first four are definitely sort of geared to either the person making a decision on their own, but the other three being very much supported and connected with someone else, those friends, those neighbors, those all of those. Now, Innovative Life Options, of course, works with employers who use In the Company of Friends, which is a self-administered model. there is also continuity care in the same building here that also helps develop support networks. And since your involvement, what would you say is the value? What benefits that individual when there's a network?
Well, I think two come to mind. One is that the individual gets to tell their story about what they might want in their life, and they may never have been formally asked that question. And they have may, and it's because it's maybe asked by other members of the community. Family has not really broached that particular topic. So I think that initial surge. And then the second thing I think I would refer to would be confidence. That, again, we go back to once you gain a little bit of experience, and if the people are friendly, trusted, and compassionate, and sincere about what they're trying to help the individual with, and that's picked up, I see and I have seen individuals blossom into a different kind of human being that never before was making their own decisions and feeling confident about it. So support networks are they're natural in some ways. Sometimes they need nourishment and encouragement themselves to get going. And there's people, you say, with in company of friends, Life Innovative Life, Continuity Care. There's resources to help families try and find a way to organize something. It's hard work.
Well, I don't know if I'd call it hard work. It is different.
Different work.
It is. It forces us to think differently, and we call that hard, right? No, it's not hard. It's different, and that makes it feel hard because we're stretching, you know? It's great for the individual who has a support network, and I think when in school, if you can create that for that student so that they don't feel isolated and, you know, occasionally they might get pulled out for OT or something like that, or I don't know, because I really pushed hard to make a circle of friends happen in high school for Millie, I saw the value of that. And so the question also comes from not just for people who are being supported as adults, but also in schools. Think, what would you say the people that are supporting someone get out of it?
Oh, wow. I think initially they think that they're helping their friend, probably one of the parents, to try and achieve something. And then I think they become more intimately involved in the life of the individual, that they come to appreciate the gifts of individuals. They come to appreciate the complexity of systems. They begin to understand how, I'll use the word difficult, it may be to create change, but with their effort, they can create a small change, which leads to another small change, which leads to another small change, which ends up being a large change in the person's life. And I think that they come away with a feeling of great satisfaction out of the whole process, that they've created something that's stable and secure and meaningful to the individual at the heart of it.
And they recognize the reciprocal part that they weren't expecting.
They weren't expecting that at all.
Yeah, I know, that's the bonus part. And that's the part, I think, it's hard to explain that you will grow out of this too. You know, it isn't just a one-sided job here. You know, right. This isn't just about being benevolent. This is about really connecting with someone and how that feels and how you as someone in a support network grow. And it's a surprise for a lot of people that it's a pleasant one, you know.
I don't know if people initially when they go and get involved in a support work, answer the question to themselves, what am I going to contribute? They may be, okay, I've got a loose identity to the family. I'm a friend. Okay. And then it grows.
It just naturally does that. Yeah. So when I look at my notes here, you identify, I mean, this report is, like you said, 84 pages, was it?
It's 84 pages. There's 16 very specific areas that are identified as area of work. There's 81 recommendations in the report. The report has been accepted, submitted to the government, accepted by the minister as a final report. And there is an implementation team that was set up inside government that was reporting initially every 3 months and then 6 months, and due for, I believe, another report in the not-too-distant future. Some of the early questions that I had, because I've worked with a lot of government reports in the past, was whether the government would take it seriously, whether they would commit to the kinds of changes that were being encouraged and forecast in the report. And I'm very pleasantly optimistic that things are moving ahead. The first announcement that was made about the report was the establishment of, a grant that was made to the, it's called the Community-Based Assisted Decision-Making Pilot Project. It's a two-year project that covers peer support, developing support networks, and working with families to understand and implement assisted decision making. And it's and then there was a further grant that was made to Inclusion Winnipeg that was for person-centered planning. Those were two really important pieces that came right off the top. And you know, then there's things that we're seeing from the commissioner's office, who is reaching out to families and through organizations to talk about what are the most important issues and how do you want to better understand how the commissioner's office works. We've now seen consultations beginning with agencies and individuals in the community to, I guess I'll say, test ideas. I think that's what it would be, to see whether there is a consensus to move forward in the way that the task force was proposing. We know that there's work being done on amendments, major amendments to the Vulnerable Persons Act that are scheduled for, well, within the next year. I think that we'll see some action on that, but they're being worked on. There's action on the area of, said, the revision to the transition protocol. Some of these are moving fast. Some of these are moving slowly.
But at least they're moving.
They are moving. I believe that the majority of the areas of the report will be acted on. One of the ones that will come out in the not too distant future is the appointment of an advisory council. It was actually the very first recommendation of the report was to set up a group that would receive information and continue to give a continuing basis of information to the department. And there's been a call for nominees, at some point in the near future, there'll be an announcement about that. And so I'm generally encouraged. You know, I mean, I'm always amazed about how long it takes to implement some things which you think should just be, boom, it should happen. You know, I thought, you know, training would be an easy one, and apparently it's more complicated than I think. So it's coming, but it's not quite there yet. They're looking into the areas of abuse, changes to the provincial reporting requirements through the provincial abuse unit, how investigations will be conducted to get consistency and to get timeliness, those kind of things. So, there's a lot. There's, I'd say, 16 areas and a lot. So I don't want to scare families by saying, you know, you need to know intimately every detail of this report. You need to know that if you have a concern and you have an inquiry, there's a group related to peer support or support networks or assisted decision-making is there that can perhaps challenge your thinking, assist your thinking, support your thinking, help you connect with support network folks or members of your community that can actually help you attain the goal. I think we're going to see a major shift in the decision-making area as a result of this report, but that will take time. So it could be a year or so off before we actually see lots of that.
I'm never surprised anymore when the whole timeline thing goes much longer, because I'm reminded of Judith Snow, who said, to govern means to slow things down. And so I've never forgotten that.
On the positive side, I see a very dedicated team of government folks at the assistant deputy minister level and below that are really, really working hard at trying to put the report into action. And if I compare that to the 2007 review, that wasn't something that was there with the same intensity. Not many things got changed as a result of that.
Yeah, so the protection part came a bit stronger, and yep. The training kicked in. That wasn't a big part of it, and the training, I think the training, hard to measure just how much of an influence it's had, but I think the training was part of the broadening of the understanding, because it it continued. It may not have had the same level of push to it as it did in the beginning, but it's still there. It still happens. And it would be nice to have it, because it's a package, I imagine, it would be nice to change it up every once in a while, because, you know, those of us who might have been part of the, who are part of, I'm not, but who are part of the training, after a while you can just shut your brain off and go, blah, 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 yada, yada, and just keep talking, right? And so that takes away from the energy of the training, and a lot of it's done online, so all of that changes.
We identified about 12 areas where training should take place in the community, and a range of topics in terms of how do we improve our policy and practices for individual planning for people.
That's a good one.
It's a big one. It's a major change. And this report calls for a greater involvement by the agencies and perhaps a lesser role for community service workers, except that they would have oversight responsibilities, but a big change. But training in the proper techniques to get good, solid individual plans is going to be a challenge. And part of the challenge is that there's a high turnover rate in community agencies, so that if you have 200 staff that are working for an agency and you have a 25% turnover in the course of a year, all of a sudden you've got to retrain a group of people that didn't get that message, but the others are saying, well, we're supposed to be doing this. And the same happens in the area of abuse. There's an obligation under the current act, and will be, it's going to be maintained, is that compulsory reporting of abuse of any shape or form. In fact, there's a recommendation to change and broaden the types of abuse that would get reported, so that, and abuse takes place in so many different ways. The common ones are financial and sexual abuse, but there's psychological abuse, there's verbal abuse that takes place, so that there's different ways. And there's a reporting requirement. And we always said the one basic thing that every worker in the field has to know is that there's compulsory reporting. And failure to report can be a criminal offense, not to report something that you've seen or had reported. So it's pass it up to have it investigated, see where it goes. Sometimes we're successful in getting, it rectified. Sometimes we're not. It leads to frustration. But if you don't report it, it's never going to happen. Getting criminal charges is difficult, there is a thing called the Adult Abuse Registry that exists. And they're being asked to make some revisions in terms of how they broaden it, because it's really hard to get onto that list. I mean, it's not one that you really want to achieve.
Yes,
that's right. And maybe that's good, but there's also, you can slip through the system that way. So, I mean, training is going to take multiple ways. You have to understand the act about planning, how you do. I mean, if you just take the four themes that you started with, rights, safeguards, planning, and decision-making. All are areas that require very specific kinds of training. And the good news is that we have a project that's going to look at assisted decision-making in a robust way. And hopefully we'll select X number of people to move away from current arrangements, or know that there's alternatives, or just really confirm that they've got the best arrangement that they can happen. Just as a statistic, is that roughly there's 2,000 people that have substitute decision makers that are in force, that are managed by the commissioner's office, the Vulnerable Persons Commissioner's office, of which half are the public trustee and roughly half are family and friends in the community. And assisted decision making, if effort is applied, you can undo that. You don't have to take away people's rights under the concept of this is the last resort, because something might happen. There's other ways of doing it, and you don't have to lock in for 5 or 10 years, and sometimes it feels like it's convenient, it's manageable, I don't have to do very much, decisions will get made, I feel safe about it. And those are all very valid concerns and comments that we heard over and over from families. Don't mess with that kind of stuff. And we're saying, just consider the options, because it's your son or daughter that's going to be the beneficiary of it.
That's right, and the encouragement of decision-making brings us back to the confidence and the feeling that I have the right to do this, and they'll speak up or react in ways that are responsible because they feel they have that right. Now, you said something just a couple of minutes ago that I was going to ask a question on, and I didn't write it down, so it disappeared like, you know, a puff of smoke. So let me ask you another one.
Sure.
So this is a 27-year-old piece of legislation now. We're, you know, in November 2022. Jump forward 20 years. What would you like to see in the world of everybody who has an intellectual disability? Where would you like to, if you were be able to look into that crystal ball, what would be the best thing for all that effort that went into creating Pathways to Dignity? What would that outcome look like or could look like?
Well, I think, again, I always answer things in two parts. The first part is that a number of, I'll say, middle-aged to older adults may or may not ever see the benefit of the work that we've done in 2021 and 22 to get to this point, because the changes will take 5 and 10 years to really make a major impact. Where I get optimistic is that families that are coming through the system that are moving into age 18 through age 35 or 40, they're going to reap the benefits of support networks. They're going to reap the benefits of peer support for families. Not to say that the older families won't. It's just, you know, I think it's going to be a more limited audience at that point to do it. My optimism would be that we'll see a major improvement in individual planning for people that will be really supportive, really well done, really well understood. It'll be taken to heart because they really believe in the values of the Act and of the individual in the case. We're going to be challenged with people with more complex needs that will be living in the community, which will mean that traditional ways of communicating will be different, so that we'll have to figure that out. We've done some of it at this stage, but it'll probably become more, because the expectation is that people will be living in the community, that they will not be in institutions. So there'll be that challenge. I think groups like Continuity Care will be called upon to do even more than what they have currently been able to look at in terms of how do I plan the future for my son or daughter so that it is safe and secure and stable when mom and dad are no longer in the picture, and what are the options there. I would like to see that, I'd hope to see that agencies, well, they're going to be large agencies, but they're going to be of a different style, you know, 10 years from now. Just as we went through the transition when this Act was being formed, apartment living and small group homes weren't as commonplace as they are today. People living on their own with hiring their own staff, I believe that will become more commonplace into the near future. But it will take the collective effort of the community and the collaboration with the government to achieve that.
It will also take evidence that says this works.
Yes.
And that's part of Innovative Life Options' role, really, and all of us who are at 120 and beyond who work in the field to show that this does work. I would add that when families and individuals go to banks or their medical professional or to some legal component, insurance or whatever, that they don't have to get pushed back on that one either. That there is an understanding that, oh, this person is assisted, they have a network, they have a group of people that are supporting them, that they get, we don't do it in the same way anymore. And so, and I picked 20 years because to reach the ideal or even get close, it will take that kind of time.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's systems that are as complicated as the systems that we work in, both in education and in family support, community life, are complicated. And that they don't pivot on a dime kind of thing, I guess is the phrase. It's a slow, gradual change.
Like one of those ships that when it moves in tiny, tiny
bits.
Increments. Yes.
But if there's something that's propelling the change, which I think this report does, and people say, I wonder whatever happened with such and such, and they continue asking questions, I think that will be where some of the encouragement comes. I mean, there will be changes of government. There will be changes of personnel in the field everywhere. It could be from a community service worker to the head of an agency to your direct care support people. People will come and go and be in and out of somebody's life. We just hope that there'll be more stability. That's really the goal that we were looking for.
And if they have a circle.
A network
around them, that's how it really changes things slowly. Yeah. Well, I think this has been a great conversation, Dale. Thank you so much for bringing us up to date on what's happening with the Vulnerable Persons Act. And as Dale mentioned, if you want to know anything more, I'll add a little tagline at the end of this. So if you want to get more information, you'll hear it. You'll be hearing a lot about more information along this line in the next little while, I'm sure. Again, thanks a lot for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I do hope you enjoyed listening to this table talk about Pathways to Dignity with Dale. We at Innovative Life Options have a vision to inspire, to include, to innovate. We have been supporting people to create self-directed lives for 30 years and are open to exploring ways to address the unmet needs of the community we serve. If you have questions or would like more information about this legislation, the community-based assisted decision-making pilot project, or anything else we talked about, you can phone toll-free 1-866-516-5445 or email info@icof-life.ca, or if you prefer, visit our website, innovativelifeoptions.ca. Thanks for listening.